Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. And today we're going to devote our 90 minutes to birds. And we're going to pick out various aspects of birds. And to begin with, we're going to talk about feathers. I, probably like you, have enjoyed looking at the brilliant plumage of many of our birds and enjoyed the feathers. But I learned a whole lot more, and in a very entertaining way, when I had the chance to read Tor Hansen's book. He's a conservation biologist. His first book was The Impenetrable Forest, My Gorilla Years in Uganda, which won the 2008 USA Book News Award for Nature Writing. He's the author most recently of Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. Tor lives with his wife and son on an island off the coast of Washington State. And he's with us by phone today to talk about his book and to talk about feathers. You may have some questions. Have you ever marveled at a feather? What is it that captures your imagination? You might have those questions or more. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment, even a photograph, right there. Tor Hansen with us by phone. Hi, Tor. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Hi, Larry. Well, thanks for having me on. It's my pleasure.
I really enjoyed reading your book. You're a very entertaining writer, and I learned an awful lot. And you're a biology... You call yourself a biology generalist, I think?
Yeah, I am a bit of an all-around biology nerd, interested in a wide range of things from primates to birds to just about everything in between.
And what first drew you to feathers?
Well, I've been fascinated with birds for a long time, and I was working on a project on vultures in Africa some years ago, and I became interested in thinking about why those vultures had lost the feathers on their head, you know, what would cause a bird to lose something so essential to its nature. And of course, for the vultures, it's because they're poking around inside dead zebras all the time, and it's a lot easier to keep a bare skin clean than a bunch of fancy feathers. So that got me thinking about feathers in an evolutionary context, and it's just been a fascination ever since.
Wow, and I tell you, you actually sat down and pulled all and counted all of the feathers on, what was it, chickadee? I read that and I thought, man, this man has patience.
Well, the horrible thing about it is I was trying to sort them into piles and different feather types. Of course, every time I coughed or moved or opened the door, something had to go blowing across the room. It was a project that took a little longer than I had originally planned on it, but it was fascinating to sit down and do it.
How many feathers are in a bird? Actually, that varies quite a bit, doesn't it?
It varies. It varies. If you look at some of our smallest birds, like a hummingbird, and in that category, you might find 1,000 feathers. And then for a typical songbird, it might be anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000. But if you look at a larger bird like a tundra swan, they could have more than 25,000 feathers.
That's an amazing number. What are the main parts of a feather, and what do those parts do?
Oh, terrific question. Well, a feather is composed of several distinct parts, and it depends really upon the style of feather and its purpose as to how it's arranged. But they all share certain features, and one of the most important is the fact that they're all tubular in structure. Now, you think to yourself, well, a feather looks flat. Well, it can't be a tube. But if you look down at the base of any feather, you'll find the calamus or quill, which is that tubular part. And so the flat part of a feather, which might be the vane for a flight feather or a contour feather, or might be a more of a fluffy bit for a down feather, that part of the feather really unfurls from the tube as it grows.
Oh, that's and they're not all, obviously, as you say, they're not all the same. Every bird has several types of feathers on its body. So there are a lot of, and they've sort of evolved to meet the specific requirements of the individual bird.
That's absolutely right. What really interests me in an evolutionary sense is that while you have many, many things in nature that are beautifully adapted to a single purpose, feathers are adapted beautifully to many different purposes.
Yes.
From insulation, you know, of course, to flight, to waterproofing, and then, of course, to the wonderful coloration and display properties of feathers.
Yeah. We have callers online who want to visit with you. By the way, you can join in, too, with a question or comment at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Ruth in Madison for her question. Hi, Ruth. Thanks for calling.
Hey, and thank you. And my question does have to do with coloration. I have pet birds, and like, for example, the macaws, the feathers might be green on one side and red on the other, or, you know, the major flight feathers, and the blue and gold would be blue on one side and gold on the other. And I was wondering, is that actual pigment, or is it just simply how the feather refracts the light, or reflects light back to us, to our eye?
Oh, that's a wonderful, wonderful question, and thanks for calling in with it. The answer is that it can be both. Feathers are colored in two very distinct ways. One is by a pigment, but the other is through structural coloration, which is exactly that, the way light is refracted from the structure of the feather itself. And they often work in combination. So, for example, some of the greens on parrots, the brilliant, brilliant greens, are made up of a pigment-based yellow combined with a structural-based green and or structural-based blue, I should say. So what our eyes perceive is a vibrant green.
Very interesting. Thank you, Ruth. Appreciate the call. Terry in Green Bay, let's go to you. Hi, Terry.
Yeah, good morning to you both. I fully understand that it is illegal to, have feathers in your possession with most birds, but if a person was to have these feathers in possession in native all these, you know, many years I've seen them around the bird feeders and whatever, what is a good way to display feathers?
Great question. Well, first of all, Terry, you're absolutely right. There are a number of laws, but particularly the Migratory Bird Act, which prohibit the possession of feathers without a federal permit. But if one were to have some or were to have a friend of a friend who had some, displaying feathers, there are a whole variety of ways to do it. People have done wonderful artwork with feathers and display for centuries and centuries. So anything from simply having them in a vase to people who have actually created art by using the different colors to essentially paint pictures with feathers. So there are a whole range of artistic uses of feathers, and many of them, of course, can be done through domestic feathers, which are legal, of course, to possess. And another point that is important with feathers and display and artwork is to remember that they need to be protected from the bacteria and lice and other things that devour them. And so periodically it can be useful to either throw your feathers in the freezer for a short period of time or into a bin where you have some mothballs or something to keep the feather parasites under control so they don't degrade.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. I'm wondering about preening. What's the purpose of preening that we see in birds?
Well, birds have to maintain their feather coat in a very healthy condition because they rely on it for so many things. To protect them from the weather, the coat needs to be waterproof, and to keep them warm, the down needs to be very insulative. And so to keep the feathers in good condition, birds preen constantly, and they do it in various ways. They apply preen oils from a gland located back near their rump. So if you see a bird that looks like it's pecking itself in the rear, it's actually getting preen oils on its bill that it will then move and use in its preening and apply it to the feathers. So preen oils help. They also simply physically repair feathers with their bills, stitching together veins that have come undone, trying to remove lice and feather mites and other things that might be infesting the feathers. So preening feathers is absolutely about maintenance for the function of those feathers.
And I have to go back to our earlier caller because as you were talking here, I was remembering something you said in your book that if you said something like, if you ever start to write a book about feathers, you will suddenly find birds and feathers on your doorstep.
Yes. I actually had birds even arrive in mail. luckily, they paid for a two-day shipment, or that would have been a stinky box. Yes, and I should point out, too, that I have permits to have what they call a salvage permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department, so the ability to gather up these feathers and birds for educational and research purposes.
Yeah.
But yes, feathers coming in from all points and a very interesting collection of things in the freezer here at our house.
Well, you know, I think most of us think of feathers like hair or maybe fingernails, but they're really appendages like fingers. Their birds are able to move them independently and subtly.
Yeah, you know, they are made up of keratin, of course, or a form of keratin. There are many types, but a form of keratin, the way that hair or fingernails are keratin as well. But feathers are, they grow in a much more complicated fashion, and they're attached in a more complex fashion, and that there are muscles and nerves at the base of the feathers that allow birds to move them individually and to feel through their feathers in that subtle variations in air pressure or wind patterns can be felt by the movement of the feathers. And so the birds use feathers in a very, very adept fashion. They can raise them or lower them. They can move them during flight to adjust and control turbulence around their wings. They're quite adept at manipulating those feathers.
Yeah, and you tell an amazing story of a hawk that skydives with his caretaker, and maybe you could share that. That has, I think, something a lot to do with what I just asked about.
Absolutely. So it's a great story, but there's a fellow here where I live, actually, on San Juan Island in Washington, who has kept falcons for many, many years and other birds of prey as well. But a particular falcon that he and his wife raised and trained, they have trained to skydive with Ken as he's jumping out of airplanes. So he tosses Frightful the falcon out of the door of the plane, and the falcon just immediately starts flying right next to the plane. And then when Ken jumps out, the falcon dives with him. And the purpose of this was to study how the bird was moving as it dove and how fast it could go. And Ken said that when he was in utter free fall, going as fast as he could, over 100 miles per hour, there would be times when the bird would assume a very aerodynamic shape and just drop out of sight. So they attached a device to the bird, to Frightful the Falcon, and measured how fast she was flying, and it, in fact, was a record. It was 242 miles per hour.
That's
in
amazing.
Free fall for that bird. So by adjusting her body shape and compressing her feathers into a streamlined shape, and then also, as Ken pointed out, there are special features on those falcon feathers that he believes help control and reduce turbulence and drag on that bird. It achieved those incredible speeds.
And pulling out the G-force when that bird pulls up.
Unbelievable. Yeah, 10 times what would make an airline pilot, an airplane pilot, go unconscious. Just incredible G-force.
10 times, yeah. Well, we're talking today with Tor Hansen, conservation biologist and author of a very engaging book. It's called Feathers. It's written by Basic. You can go online to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You'll get a direct link to that book. And I hope you'll join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with author and conservation biologist Tor Hansen. His latest book is titled Feathers, and the subtitle, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. Great to have him with us today. Thank you so much for listening in on the conversation. And we'll take some more calls here. And Carol in Scales Mount, Illinois, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Carol.
Hi to you both, and I'm enjoying your program. Thank you very much, Larry. They're always interesting.
Thanks.
Earlier, Mr. Hansen was talking about the adaptation of vultures to losing the feathers on their head, and I just hatched a bunch of guinea eggs, so I have 8 keets who have beautiful feathers on their head. However, their parents lose their feathers on their head, and they're not carnivorous. They don't, I mean, they eat ticks, thankfully, and I'm wondering what reason could they come out of the egg feathered and then not have feathers on their head as adults?
Oh, Carol, this is a wonderful question. Yes, so you have the chicks with feathered heads, and then they lose them later on. And what it shows is that there's a use for having a bare head for that species develops later in their lives. And in fact, in that case, it's a display for attracting mates and for showing that they are mature birds, in that the colored skin on the head of that bird is part of their, essentially a part of their plumage. And you see that in a number of species as well. Another reason for losing feathers is to reveal some very colorful skin that can be part of a mating display or the plumage that signifies adulthood.
Very cool.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Nature is amazing, isn't she?
It certainly is.
Mike in Reedsburg, we turn to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I've just been driving across central Wisconsin seeing quite a few sandhill cranes, and they have just changed color, or some of them have not quite changed yet. They've gone from a dusty sort of reddish-brown summer color going to a gray for winter, and some other birds change colors during the season, too. I'm thinking of goldfinches. How do they accomplish the change of color?
Okay, Mike, yeah, the change of color in birds is accomplished through their molting process. They replace their feathers in some birds several times a year, and for almost all birds, at least once per year, they replace the feathers on their body. And they do it for several reasons, one of which is simply that feathers wear out. We talked earlier about how to preserve feathers from mites and lice and bacteria that degrade them. Well, over time, feathers wear out, and birds need fresh ones simply to keep the feather coat functioning. But they can also change their feathers, change the color when they molt in new feathers, and this often happens seasonally to signify when they're coming into a breeding plumage. That's often a much more bright plumage, particularly for males. But in some cases, you might not want very bright plumage for the whole year if you're trying to blend in and hide from predators. So you often see in birds a very brightly colored male during the breeding season may molt into a very dull color for the rest of the year when they're much more concerned about staying out of sight than they are about attracting a mate.
There you go.
Very interesting.
Yeah, thanks, Mike, for calling. Thomas in Manitowoc, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
I guess you just kind of answered my question there. I was going to ask you what triggers a molt in birds. In my domestic chickens and turkeys, they always molt at different times, where when I look down at the wild geese on the river, they all seem to be able to time out their molt as a whole flock, and they'll be hiding down there for 2 weeks, and during that molt, they're totally quiet, so that predators don't know that they're molting. And I was just wondering how they're all triggered to molt at the same time. So I guess this kind of relates to your last question.
Yeah, sure does.
It does, but it's even more nuanced than that. You're making some wonderful observations right there, in that some birds will molt feathers sort of sequentially, particularly for their flight feathers, in that they never want to lose the ability to fly because it's such an essential skill for a bird. But there are birds, and particularly some water birds, some ducks and some geese and some seabirds, who molt the flight feathers very quickly, and they actually go through a period of time where they're flightless. So when birds do that, then they are indeed particularly quiet and stealthy during that period where they have no ability to escape through the air. And one other thing about the molt that's quite interesting, and this has to do with what you'll be seeing in your domestic birds, your chickens and whatnot, is that when those birds are molting, you know darn well you're not going to get any eggs out of them, and it's a really great signal for how much energy it takes for a bird to grow those complicated and essential things called feathers,
yeah.
And that they can't afford the energy to make eggs while they're doing that.
And we'll get to, thank you very much for that call. We'll get to Bob here in Athelstane, Wisconsin in a minute. But there was an email from Vicki that kind of relates to this. We have, Tor, we have a large wild turkey population here in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And Vicki emails to say, I recently saw an all-white turkey in a large flock of wild turkeys. Was I seeing things, or is this even possible? How common might that be?
Oh, interesting question. So an all-white turkey in with a flock of wild turkeys. Now, there are a couple of possibilities. One is simply that it could be a domestic turkey
that got away.
That got away and is simply flocking with those birds. That might be the most likely thing. But if you look closely, and in fact it does absolutely resemble a wild turkey, there may be some kind of a quirk in that individual that makes it impossible for it to fix pigments in its feathers. Sometimes you will see white feathers on crows or ravens, and it's a quirk, again, where those feathers, in that follicle at least, they lack the ability to fix the pigments in place, or the structure is malformed in some way. So that's also a possibility. But I think probably the strongest contender there is that it's a domestic turkey flocking with its wild.
I think that you may be well right there, because we have lots of domestic turkeys in the state as well.
Okay.
Bob in Athelstane, Wisconsin, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Ah, it's a great show. I'm really glad to hear this. You know, I'm also a biologist, and I took up fly tying many years ago, and I guess I have a comment. And I would suggest that anyone who's really interested in feather morphology or the structural biology of feathers should talk to a fly tier, because there are so many feathers for so many different uses, and they understand it because they're looking at them in such great detail. And I'd love to hear your comments.
Yeah, and Tor had a great chapter in his book about a fly tier. Go ahead, Tor.
Well, absolutely. I thought, boy, this is... I really have a wonderful excuse to learn about fly fishing in writing this book. So I did meet with a great fly tier and fly fishing guide in Oregon and had a fly tying lesson from him. Mm-hmm. And his observations, as you point out, they were right on the mark. What an intimate understanding of feather structure fly tiers have from working with the feathers in such a detailed manner to achieve the incredible beauty and function of flies for fishing. So, in fact, fly tying is a great insight into feathers, and I encourage any listener to hop online and take a look at the pictures online of some of the wonderful flies that are tied professionally and by amateurs.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bob. Good point. And we'll go to Bob in Elroy, Wisconsin next. Hi, Bob.
Yes, I would like the guest to comment on the recent discovery of dinosaur feathers embedded in amber as a really significant evolutionary discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Bob, this is wonderful, wonderful stuff. One of the fun things about this book has been how much is happening right now in our understanding of the evolution of feathers. Now, for many, many years, we had really only one fossil, one species fossilized to look at, and that was a creature called Archaeopteryx, an old fossil from Germany with beautifully preserved feathers, which people called for many years the first bird, 150 million years old. And then more recently, a number of fossils coming out of China.
Mm-hmm.
That include a lot of feathered dinosaurs from a particular group of dinosaurs, the meat eaters, called the theropods. And now, even more recently, we have this wonderful discovery from up in Canada, in Alberta, where they discovered feathers preserved in amber. And even more interesting, it's not simply one type of feather, but they discovered five different, distinct different types of feather in that amber, and they correspond to the stages of feather evolution from the theory of how feathers evolved, the most recent theory, which looks at all the necessary steps in the evolution of feathers to create something as complex as a modern plume. You have to have a simple quill. You have to be able to divide it into filaments. You have to have those filaments organized around a central rachis. All these things have to happen, and they're able to see that level of detail in these wonderful, wonderful feathers in amber.
And we have on my Facebook page, Judith posted a National Geographic photo essay that we had permission to post about those amber findings, the feathers in the amber, and they're spectacular photographs, and I would urge you to take a look at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can click on that, and we'll get you right to it. They are amazing photos, aren't they?
Oh, they're absolutely beautiful, and they've even preserved, you know, hints of what the color of some of those feathers were, which can be discerned as well from some fossils of feathers in stone, but even more beautifully in these wonderful amber preserved specimens.
We had a caller from Wisconsin Rapids who has an antique lady's fan with very downy, fluffy, white feathers. It's yellowed with age. She'd like to know how to clean it.
How to clean feathers? Well, this is a wonderful question that I put to one of the conservators at the American Museum of Native American Museum in Washington, D.C., part of the Smithsonian. And she was adamant that cleaning feathers is a process that you'd want to do dry, because the enemy of the feather is water. So they use very simple techniques for cleaning and repairing feathers, but taking bits of dry sponge and sponging and gently rubbing the feathers to try and clean off any debris that has been attached there. And they also use their fingers, simply enough, when the feathers have, say, the vein has become unzipped in certain places, you can actually make the feather vein come back together, reattach it by running that through your fingers. And so their cleaning techniques are really quite simple, patient and careful, essentially dry cleaning techniques.
And the fan question reminds me of a chapter that you have in your book on how feathers have been used by humans over the years.
Oh, yes. Well, this is, you know, one of the amazing things is for a biologist like myself coming at this project from my knowledge of birds and feathers in the wild and seeing all the uses there, then to turn to the cultural uses and find that they're equally, if not more, diverse. So people have used feathers not only for things like fly tying, but to stuff the interior of golf balls. We've used feathers for corsets, and of course we've used feathers in fashion for thousands of years, borrowing them from the birds and then using them for display on ourselves, from the plumes on military helmets to the wonderful hats that were so brilliantly plumed in the late 19th, early 20th century. And it's even coming back, they tell me, in a big way in fashion these days. You can tune in to the latest edition of American Idol and take a look at Steven Tyler, one of the judges on the show, and you may see feathers woven into his hair or on great earrings, and this is the latest permutation of this great history of feather fashions.
And this actually brings up an email that I have from Victor, who talks about the current trend of feathers in hairstyles. This is worrisome, he feels, considering the many extinct species following the hat feather trend in the past. Is there any regulation to this?
Yes, there is. That's a really good thing to point out, and that when the height of the feather boom was occurring in the late 19th, early 20th century, there were species driven near to extinction, you know, as the hunters attacked populations of wild birds for their plumes, things like the great egret and herons and various others, birds of paradise. The modern feather craze is being supplied from, actually this is happening at the expense of fly fishermen, because they're the rooster feathers primarily that are raised for fly tying. And so where a year ago you might have been able to buy a full cape of prime rooster hackle for $100, it would be more than $1,000 today if you could even find it. So the modern craze in feathers seems to be directed towards domestic birds, which is necessary in that we could not possibly support the level of wild hunting that went on 100 years ago to supply feathers for fashion.
Well, another use for feathers is in pillows. And your research, you know, took you all over the place. It's really fascinating, including the factory where feathers are processed to make a lot of the down and feather products that we use on a daily basis. And maybe you could, I thought the description of the facility was interesting. Maybe you could talk about that. And what did you learn about feathers there?
Well, this was a lot of fun. I wondered how would I ever, you know, get an insight into the feather and down industry. And so I took the first logical step. I read the label on my pillow, and it said Pacific Coast Feather Company. So I called these people up and got a tour of their processing facility, which is a wonderful factory. It looked like something out of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, with all these tubes and bins and feathers flying through the air. And the processing for feathers is remarkably simple. You know, these birds are taken from the birds and primarily from the poultry trade, mostly in Asia, where ducks and geese are very popular on the menu. But then the feathers are simply cleaned and dried and sorted. That's really all you need to do before they're ready to go into a pillow or a ski parka or a down jacket of some kind. And so what they do is clean them up, they wash them, they air dry them, and then they blow them into a three-story chamber. And the side of it is filled with windows so you can watch what's happening in there. And you see these plumes, these downy plumes, just swirling in the air in this chamber. And, of course, the lightest plumes stay in the air longer than the heavier ones. And they're, so they're able to sort the plumes into different grades of down based on how long they are suspended in that air column. And it's just a wonderful thing to see.
Yeah. And the lighter, the more valuable?
The most valuable are those that are the finest plumes, the lightest ones. They are very lightweight, and they have, you know, this structure with an incredible amount of surface area. And so they're wonderful insulation because they trap more air per weight than really any other insulation that we've ever come up with.
And I thought your conversation with the fellow who actually does the purchasing and so forth was quite interesting as well as to how these feathers are purchased.
Yeah, it's great. The fellow I was talking with, named Travis Steer, who works at Pacific Coast, he goes to Asia constantly to buy feathers from the feather brokers over there. And he told me that in every village in China, for example, there's some fellow on a bicycle going around from farm to farm buying feathers from farmers. And he, you know, gets the feathers straight off of their birds after they've slaughtered their flock for the year, and then he stores them in his house and sells them to a fellow in a truck who takes them on to a distributor, and they end up packaged in these huge unsorted bales of feathers that are then shipped to the United States or Europe or other places where there's a market for feather down.
Yeah, it was really interesting. We had an email from Deanna in Superior. And she wonders, why do pigeons come in a wide variety of patterns and colors when most bird species kind of all look alike? So a downy woodpecker looks like another downy woodpecker, but pigeons...
Why are pigeons so differently colored? And well, the answer is because we have meddled with them so much through the years for breeding beautiful varieties of pigeons. And so what you see in these the common pigeon or rock dove is a domesticated bird that has since you know escaped back into our cities and countryside. But we've bred those over centuries for different traits, for different colors, and for different flight habits. And so when you see them then back in the wild, they display all these different color traits and various patterns that have been selected for artificially through our own breeding programs.
Yeah. I think one of the, and this kind of goes back to the evolution that we were talking about earlier, one of the fascinating scientific debates is whether feathers and wings developed in earthbound creatures to allow them to fly, or whether they evolved in tree-dwelling animals so that they could glide and eventually fly. What's the consensus, if any, and based on what proof?
Yeah, well, consensus may not be the word to use there.
This
has been something that ornithologists and paleontologists have argued about for years, and they summarize it by saying you're either someone who believes in the tree-down theory or the ground-up theory. And the idea, or the difference really, is this. You know, did the first soaring or flying creatures need to take advantage of gravity and leap from trees for feathers to evolve in that context and wings and what have you? Or was this a situation where the creatures were on the ground and they were leaping into the air either to escape from predators or to catch prey out of the air, that type of thing? And this has been going on for years and years, arguing about it. One of the most interesting and I think one of the most promising theories to answer this question actually has a little bit of both. And this is something called wing-assisted incline running, developed by a fellow named Ken Dial at the University of Montana. And Ken was observing the way that young partridges, a ground bird, the chuckar partridge, learned to fly. And he had them in a lab at his station there, where he was expecting these birds to leap from pedestal to pedestal as they developed, their wing feathers grew in, and as they started to learn flying techniques. But what he noticed, and he and his son were working together on this, and his son told him, "Dad, the birds are cheating." They were running straight up the side of these pedestals and not leaping from pedestal to pedestal. And what was happening was the birds were using their developing wings to give themselves better traction as they ran up an incline. And through a series of experiments, they were able to demonstrate that not only young partridges and other ground birds, but many, many different birds use their wings in this way. Even a half-formed wing gives them increased traction, just like the spoiler on the back of a race car.
Yeah.
Helps push those wheels down to the ground, especially if they're going around a curve or something. Well, birds can do that with their wings, use the aerodynamic qualities of a wing to give themselves traction to run up the sides of things and get out of the way, get away from predators or other things. So that does two things. It gives this ground-up theory some traction, if you will, and that they can use a half-formed wing to get out of the way of predators. But it also, you know, has a bit of a tree down sense to it as well, because once you're up on something, well, how are you going to get down? You can leap off it and flap your wings.
Oh, boy. Just one of many fascinating things discussed in Tor Hansen's book titled Feathers. Have you ever had an interest in nests? Because our next author has a book out on avian architecture. Have you ever been interested in nests?
Oh, absolutely, and I am going to tune in so I can hear your conversation with Peter, because I know it will be fascinating.
Oh, and thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. It's a fascinating book, and we certainly enjoyed talking with you today, Tor.
Well, thanks for having me on, and many thanks to your listeners for the excellent, excellent question.
Yeah. Tor Hansen, it's spelled T-H-O-R, pronounced, so it's spelled like Thor, pronounced Tor, Tor Hansen. And his book is Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. It's published by Basic, and we have a direct link to it on my Facebook page, so you can just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you will find it there. Well, from feathers, we're turning to nests. And I'm telling you, avian architecture is something to behold, and Peter Goodfellow will be telling us all about it next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.